Today, on this episode of the PeerDirect Special Spotlight.
Yeah, I agree. I think in many ways, our understanding of CNS activity and predicting CNS activity is in its infancy. And when it comes to antibody-drug conjugates, as you said, I think many of us thought these are large molecules. They won't cross the blood-brain barrier. We now know, of course, that the blood-tumor barrier is likely more permeable and may underlie the activity of some of these larger molecules, which are crossing and offering CNS activity.
Today, Doctors Cooper and Roto join the podcast to discuss managing CNS involvement in HER2-positive lung cancer in this PeerDirect Specialist Spotlight. All opinions expressed are those of the presenters and do not necessarily reflect the views of this educational initiative's supporters.
Hello, I'm Dr. Alyssa Cooper. I'm a medical oncologist at Dana-Farber Cancer Institute here in Boston, Massachusetts, and I'm on faculty at Harvard Medical School.
And I'm Dr. Julia Roto. I'm a medical oncologist and the clinical director of the Lowe Center for Thoracic Oncology at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. I'm also an assistant professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School.
Thanks for joining us. Today, we'll focus on central nervous system involvement in HER2-positive non-small cell lung cancer. Brain metastases are a frequent challenge in lung cancer, and they can influence how we think about testing, monitoring, and systemic therapy choices. How does that sound to you, Julia?
That sounds great, Alyssa.
What's your approach to baseline CNS imaging and ongoing monitoring in HER2-positive non-small cell lung cancer? Do you find this influences how you plan systemic treatment?
Yeah, I do think this is, a significant challenge for lung cancer across the board, but particularly in certain oncogene-driven subsets. We know that CNS metastases, either at baseline or during the course of therapy, are very common for these patients, and they can drive significant morbidity in their side effects related to the emergence of CNS involvement, as well as eventually drive mortality for our patients with this disease, as these become increasingly more challenging to treat with effective systemic therapies. And that means that, as in all patients with lung cancer with advanced or metastatic diagnosis, a brain MRI to stage for CNS involvement is really important at baseline and to help guide decision-making about the appropriateness of local targeted therapies like radiation-based treatments versus systemic therapies like some of the agents we're going to be talking about. And then during the course of therapy, it's reasonable to consider brain imaging, for example, a brain MRI intermittently during the course of therapy. I'll typically do it every 6 to 12 months during the course of treatment, but there is practice variation in how often and whether people are surveilling the CNS and those without baseline CNS involvement. For those who do have CNS disease, of course, it's really important to include CNS restaging as part of your routine cancer monitoring on therapy. So, Alyssa, CNS metastases are unfortunately common in lung cancer, including in HER2-positive disease. How do you think about the role of CNS involvement when you're now coming to decisions about treating these patients?
Yeah, thanks for reviewing the indications for imaging and how we should be monitoring these patients. I would also note that I will have a much lower threshold to take a report of a patient very seriously if someone with HER2-positive disease does tell me that they have a little bit of dizziness or a little bit of tingling or numbness somewhere. I will be very quick to image the CNS in these patients, perhaps. Considering the role of the CNS is very important for patients both with and without baseline brain metastases, and brain penetrance is one of the most important things that we think about when choosing a therapy for our patients. This has been looked at for the available HER2-targeting agents. So for trastuzumab deruxtecan, we were actually surprised. We thought potentially an antibody-drug conjugate that was such a big molecule, so clunky potentially, wouldn't penetrate the CNS, wouldn't be able to get in past the blood-brain barrier to treat active disease there. But surprising, there actually was a pooled analysis of the DESTINY-Lung01 and O2 trials, and there was pretty good CNS efficacy shown in that trial with an intracranial response rate of about 50%, and an additional 40 or 45% did have stable disease in that pooled analysis of just about 30 patients. So only a few patients did have frank progression in the CNS on that therapy. It's also been looked at in zongertinib, the TKI that was just approved for the later line setting for HER2-positive non-small cell lung cancer. cancer. And the intracranial response rate was just under 50% in that setting. But of course, you know, this is really being looked at quite actively, and it will be something that we really need to think about in a multidisciplinary fashion. I would always involve my radiation oncology colleagues to figure out, is this something that could be safely watched with systemic therapy? Is this disease that should be, you know, quickly targeted with local therapy because it has high risk of symptoms or morbidity if there's progression? So I would always ask my colleagues what to do in this scenario, potentially my neuro-oncology and radiology colleagues as well.
Yeah, I agree. I think in many ways, our understanding of CNS activity and predicting CNS activity is in its infancy. When it comes to antibody-drug conjugates, as you said, I think many of us thought these are large molecules. They won't cross the blood-brain barrier. We now know, of course, that the blood-tumor barrier is likely more permeable and may underlie the activity of some of these larger molecules, which are crossing and offering CNS activity.
When you look at the HER2-targeted therapies available, which ones show the most evidence of activity in the CNS, and how much weight do you give that in decision-making?
Yes, as you mentioned, both agents have response rates around 45 to 50% within the CNS. So these are good, but certainly not the kind of 80% plus numbers we've seen with some modern generations of TKIs against other targets like EGFR and ALK, where you might approach systemic therapy alone with great confidence that it's unlikely that you're going to see CNS progression initially on a targeted therapy. So here, response rates around, again, 50% or a little less. I think you have to be more cautious when you're using these agents alone for systemic control of CNS disease. It's still a very reasonable choice for patients with small lesions, but certainly to have greater caution in a patient with a large or symptomatic lesion or a lesion in a particularly critical area like the thalamus or the brainstem, other areas, or cerebellum, where you might worry more about symptoms should the lesion progress. So I agree, it's really a multidisciplinary discussion, whether we feel comfortable treating with a systemic agent or reaching for radiation-based treatment first. But I really do emphasize that these do have CNS activity, and therefore, for many patients, I do think a trial of systemic therapy with close monitoring can be really reasonable for a patient with asymptomatic lesions.
I totally agree. And I do think we're learning more and more about the interaction of radiation or local therapy and potential systemic therapies. For example, there have been some reports that there is potential higher rate of radionecrosis in patients who have received antibody-drug conjugates. Whether that bears out, you know, across antibody-drug conjugates or for all patients, remains to be seen. But we are not totally sure how all of these therapies completely interact with each other yet. And so, you know, making the best decision you can at the time for the patient in front of you with the knowledge we have today is really the best we can do today.
So, Alyssa, when you're managing a patient with HER2-positive non-small cell lung cancer who does develop brain metastases during the course of therapy, how do you integrate that into your treatment approach compared to someone without CNS disease? We talked a little bit about this, but how do you balance the idea of a local therapy option like surgery or radiation with a systemic or HER2-directed therapy?
It's a really good question about what to do with somebody who develops CNS progression alone without concomitant systemic progression. I think that ends up being a different clinical scenario than for someone who has both CNS progression and systemic progression. Sometimes when I have somebody on a therapy, whether it's chemoimmunotherapy or a targeted therapy or a clinical trial or other, you know, if the systemic disease is controlled, if there's no progression in the body and there is some growth in the CNS, I think we are often reaching for local therapy as sort of an oligoprogression paradigm where we try to kind of stave that CNS progression at bay with some local radiation to try to keep the patient on the systemic therapy that has been working for the rest of the disease. You know, we don't have infinite therapies for our patients. We have to be cautious about switching therapies too quickly, I find. And so if someone has CNS-only progression, I do try to, you know, maintain the patient on the therapy that they were on prior until something really forces my hand that we are going to need to switch. If they were not formally on a CNS-penetrant drug, like if they were just on, for example, immunotherapy alone, which we potentially might not have these patients on, that might trigger my potential to switch therapy at this point, but that's not usually the case in this particular patient population. If someone does have CNS disease progression in the setting of also concomitant systemic disease progression, I do feel like my hand is forced to make a systemic therapy switch, and I would try to pick one that is, you know, as CNS penetrant as possible. We know patients with brain metastases are sometimes underrepresented in clinical trials. How confident are you that the CNS activity we're seeing in studies reflects what happens in practice?
Yeah, this is also a real challenge, both for our patients when they're trying to seek novel therapies, but also in drug development, trying to establish as quickly as possible whether an agent is a CNS-active agent and how well we can rely upon it in clinical practice. We know that many clinical trials require patients to have treated stable, asymptomatic CNS disease. So even the kind of CNS lesions that we often see in studies very much underestimate the extent and the intensity or aggressiveness of CNS involvement we encounter in real-life practice. Many studies also exclude patients with leptomeningeal disease, which is another very significant clinical challenge, but which we know even less than treating, say, parenchymal CNS disease, which sometimes is permitted in studies. So for our patients, I think we really do need to know more about the activities of agents in these very challenging patient subsets. Now, as you highlighted, we do have some data from the existing prospective trials for our current available HER2 agents, including an untreated CNS lesion. So these were involved, but these would have been asymptomatic lesions. And whether this translates fully to patients with more significant symptomatic involvement, and whether this translates to patients with leptomeningeal involvement, still, I think we don't have a lot of prospective data to guide us.
And I'll just piggyback on something that you've pointed out with the enrollment of these patients in clinical trials. These patients are often getting imaged potentially every 6 weeks or maybe even sooner if they do have brain metastases, which is sometimes a bit hard to pursue in real-world clinical practice. So that's another area that I think is challenging to extrapolate from clinical trials to real life. Thanks for joining me today, Julia. This has been great. And thank you for joining us for our discussion on managing CNS involvement in HER2-positive lung cancer.
And that's today's Specialist Spotlight. Thank you for joining us for this episode of PureDirect Medical News Podcast. For more stories like these, visit us at PureDirect.com. Thoughts, comments, or suggestions, please leave us a review on your preferred listening platform or email us at editorial@PureDirect.com. Subscribe to our podcast on Spotify, Pandora, Apple Podcasts, or TuneIn. You can also download our Amazon Alexa Flash Briefing Medical News Roundup and just ask, "What's my flash briefing?" Thanks today to our guests, Drs. Cooper and Roto. Join me next time for an episode where we cover the latest stories in the world of medicine.